Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as, well, an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of the people whose intelligence is extraordinary and whose gift for communicating it to the rest of us in the form of his reports at the Washington Times at the moment is its national security reporter par excellence, Rowan Scarborough. He is, in addition, the author of two terrific books, Rumsfeld's War and Sabotage. It's always good to have him with us. Rowan, welcome back.
Thank you, Frank. Good to be with you.
Well, I thought I'd start by asking you a couple of questions about people who have suddenly emerged as prominent figures in the new Trump administration in waiting. Just yesterday, we learned that former Marine four-star general John Kelly would be the president-elect's choice to be his Secretary of Homeland Security. You followed John Kelly's distinguished career for a long time, Rowan. Talk a little bit about his past and what it might mean about his future.
He's a very well-respected Marine officer. You cannot find anybody on the left or right to say a bad word about General Kelly. A side note is that he's a Gold Star dad, that his Marine officer son was killed in Afghanistan by an IED. So his family made the ultimate sacrifice. And he is very much unpolitically correct. He gave a speech to some Marines up in New York in which he talked about the difference between Marine millennials and the millennials that are in college wanting pampered treatment and they don't want to have their feelings hurt. And he compared that with a Marine millennial who is totally dedicated to his or her country. So that he's not politically correct.
You know, Rowan, that really reminds me of a very deeply held tenet of mine, which is that the natural leaders of this millennial generation are really the veterans. And whether they're Marines or whether they've served in other services, I think it's the greatest hope we have for that particular age cohort. But let me ask you about one particular role that he played. In fact, the capstone of his distinguished military career was as the commander of Southern Command. He was in that role particularly, I thought, plain-speaking, candid, and accurate in his assessment of what was happening south of our border, what it meant as a national security problem, and in particular, the imperative of enhancing the security of that southern border. Give us a background on that, if you would, Rowan Scarborough.
Yeah, Frank, you've hit the nail on the head. This is what attracted Donald Trump to John Kelly. Obviously, immigration reform is in the top five things that Trump wants to get done. He wants to seal that border and stop the insanity of criminals going back and forth and people coming in we don't know. In 2015, General Kelly testified before the Senate Armed Services Committee, and he touched on the southern border, not just a socioeconomic problem, but a national security problem, and that we are reaching the point where Islamic terrorists are going to use that porous system to start putting terrorists in. And that is bingo to Donald Trump. He wants a border hawk.
One of the areas of the world that we have least attended to over many, many decades is, unfortunately, our own hemisphere, our some called backyard. I think of it as our front yard. I hope that John Kelly will, in his new role, be able to help intensify the attention that we are paying there. Hey, let me turn to one other very important appointment, and that is that of another retired four-star Marine general, James Mattis, to become the Secretary of Defense. This is a principal area of your beat. Tell us about Jim Mattis's background and what you think his appointment means, Rowan.
Again, a very well respected Marine by Democrats and by Republicans. He is steeped in military history and diplomatic history, and he gave a talk at the Heritage Foundation about a year ago where he said that our global strategy does not exist. That the problem with fighting ISIL is that we have no overriding strategy on what we want to do. This is what attracted him to Donald Trump, because Donald Trump's number one national security is not Russia. It's not necessarily Iran. It's ISIL. He wants a strategy to come out of General Mattis and Michael Flynn, his national security advisor, for how to destroy the group as fast as possible. And that's something that James Mattis is going to give him with the help of his friend, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
You know, one of the things that I've struck by is that Donald Trump has been able to focus more broadly. While ISIS has been a particular concern, of course, as you know, Rowan Scarborough, on the 15th of August, he talked about a much more comprehensive approach to the threat of this ideology. He actually used the term Sharia to describe it, the values that flow from that, that are hostile to our Constitution, the need to stop importing jihadists in this country, as well as to rework the Iran deal. I mean, it's a roll up, by the way, the networks that are radicalizing Muslims in our own country. So this is what makes this team, Mike Flynn, John Kelly, Jim Mattis, so impressive to me, and I have high hopes for them. Let me ask you about one other thing. In addition to talking about political Islam in that speech at Heritage Foundation, I believe it was there, as you've reported, Rowan, that General Mattis talked about the sort of perhaps delusional character of Vladimir Putin and the dangers that may flow from that. One of your colleagues and our friends at the Washington Times, Bill Gertz, has just written a piece about this new underwater submarine drone that could conceivably pack a doomsday weapon, 100 megaton dirty bomb, if you will. They call it the Canyon at the Pentagon. As you look at the Russian portfolio and Donald Trump's comments on the one hand, Jim Mattis's rather, it seems to me, more sober assessment of the guy, where do you think we're likely to go with relations with the Russians, Rowan?
I think that Jim Mattis is going to look at one of his objectives is to educate Donald Trump about Putin. I think he's already started to do that, and I think he will do that as Secretary of Defense. And I think Donald Trump will come to realize what a threat Putin has become to the West and to what we want to do in the Middle East. I mean, just quickly, look what Putin has created. And he's created an Iranian-Syria Hezbollah axis that now has changed the entire balance of power in the Middle East away from us and toward Iran, the chief sponsor of terrorism in the world. And this has to be lectured to the president-elect, that you have to stop complimenting Putin and start talking to him in a more realpolitik way about, if he continues to make moves like this, especially against the West, that there are going to be consequences. So I think this will be one of the biggest developments out of Mattis.
We will be watching that closely. You will be reporting on it, as always, scrupulously, I know. And it's one of the most important of the various security policy challenges this president will inherit from a man who has done much, I fear, to encourage and embolden Putin's misconduct and perhaps his ambitions, his designs on us, and not just the Shiite crescent, as it's being called in the Middle East, but real threats to our country as well. Lastly, very quickly, I'm going to be speaking momentarily with Fred Flights. Any insights into the sweepstakes for the Secretary of State, Rowan Scarborough?
That is like trying to pick the Kentucky Derby winner, isn't it? We almost have a 14-horse field now. It is surprising that he has entertained this many people. You know, we got to love the way how he does this in the open. So who gets to the country club? Who gets on the elevator? It's fascinating to watch. And I guess it will take a book in about a year or so to describe why Trump is having so much doing so much study on this one position, whereas he's named the other people fairly quickly. He must view it as in his own mind that this is the most important position that I'm going to name because of the things I'm going to start doing around the world. And so that's why he's taking his time.
Well, he may well be right on all of that. We'll look forward to that being the third book in your triumvirate, Rumsfeld's War and Sabotage, Rowan Scarborough, the first two. Come back to us again very soon with your insights on all of these issues. They're very, very valued, as is your great work at The Washington Times, Rowan. Keep it up. We'll talk with you again very soon. Next up, as promised, my colleague Fred Flights on the Secretary of State sweepstakes. Might John Bolton have the inside track? That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. In the House, in a virtual sense at least, is the Senior Vice President for Policy and Programs at the Center for Security Policy, my colleague and friend Fred Flights. He is, you all know, a career intelligence professional, having served as an analyst at the Central Intelligence Agency for about 20 years as the chief of staff to John Bolton in the Department of State, and also as a member of the professional staff of the House Intelligence Committee. He is the author of a very important book, Obama Bomb, A Dangerous and Growing National Security Fraud. Also, the editor of several important books, including one we'll be talking about in a moment, Putin's Reset, The Bear is Back, and How America Must Respond. Fred Flights, it's good to have you as always. Welcome.
Good to be here, Frank.
Well, I was talking in the previous segment with our friend Rowan Scarborough at the Washington Times about some of the appointments the president-elect has made to senior national security posts. One that he has yet to make, as of our conversation at least, is that of Secretary of State. He's giving it such care. He's interviewing so many candidates that it presumably reflects his appreciation that in his administration, international affairs, foreign policy, national security more broadly, is going to play a very, very prominent role. I know you have a preferred candidate in these sweepstakes, the man you served when he was last in the Department of State as an undersecretary. Talk a little bit about, if you would, why you think, as frankly do I, John Bolton would be the best choice for Secretary of State by Donald Trump.
Well, I had the privilege of working for Mr. Bolton when he was Assistant Secretary for International Organizations in the first Bush administration, and when he was Undersecretary for Arms Control in the second. And I just think he has a very keen mind that allows him to have an understanding of national security that is really hard to match. He's a good administrator, contrary to distortions in the news media. He treated his people well. But, you know, he did not stand for people trying to undermine or sabotage Bush administration policy, and he spoke up when this kind of thing went on. I think he has the capability to use diplomacy. We saw that when he started something called the Proliferation Security Initiative. This is an alliance outside of the UN that actually convinced Muammar Gaddafi to give up its weapons of mass destruction. And he knows how to be tough.
He does indeed. And one of the reasons why I think we're seeing such opposition to him from certain establishment circles, certainly from those in the bureaucracy at the State Department, and from Rand Paul as well, is that toughness. In Rand Paul's case, it seems he's particularly obsessing about what he perceives to have been John Bolton's role in the Iraq War, the effort to liberate that country from Saddam Hussein's predations. You've actually written about the record here, what role John played or, more to the point, didn't play in that affair.
I did. I wrote a piece in Breitbart last week where I explained that Bolton was not involved in any way in promoting the war with Iraq or in Iraq war planning. The reason is that Secretary of State Colin Powell and his deputy Richard Armitage cut Bolton out completely. And I knew this because I was Bolton's chief of staff. People who worked for Bolton in his bureaus were not allowed to send Bolton information. Powell and Armitage jealously guarded this information. Remember when Colin Powell went to the UN Security Council to explain the evidence, the intelligence for the war in Iraq? Bolton wasn't allowed to play any role in that. So, you know, Colin Powell goes around pouting that he played a role in promoting the Iraq war. And the reality is he did play a role in promoting the Iraq war, and he prevented John Bolton in playing one.
Interesting. Presumably, again, Fred Flights, the concern here is that were John Bolton to be the Secretary of State and were he to be bringing to bear the kinds of skill sets that you're talking about, particularly with respect to management of the department, it would really represent an impediment to the tendencies of that bureaucracy to act at cross purposes with the positions of, well, particularly Republican presidents, and most especially, I suspect, this one. From your perspective, as a guy who's spent a fair amount of time inside the senior reaches of the department, talk a little bit about sort of the political orientation, affinities, and agendas of the people who tend to inhabit that building, the Foreign Service officers, the professional permanent bureaucracy, if you will, particularly.
Well, there's a strong Democratic and liberal bias within the Department of State. I think most of them are professionals who are not political, but there's a sizable number who are. And I think their approach to dealing with appointed officials is to outlast them and to delay and to obstruct their policies. And I regret that I saw this on many, many occasions when John Bolton was under Secretary of State for Arms Control. And as bad as it was during the Bush years, I think it is going to be much, much worse during the Trump administration. And that's why we need someone who understands the State Department bureaucracy, has experience in keeping it in line. And I can't think of anyone more qualified to do that than John Bolton.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Fred, one other piece of this, which I think most of us outside of official circles, certainly outside of the Washington Beltway, would have very little appreciation of, is a practice that is known as burrowing in. Would you talk a little bit about what outgoing, primarily, most especially, Democratic administrations have tended to do to further stack the deck against Republican successors?
Well, there is a tendency, I think it's more, happens more often during Democratic administrations, but Republican administrations do this too, of bringing in political appointees who are supposed to be there temporarily during the term of a president, and they then burrow in to become career officials to remain in the following administration. Now, there's two problems with this. First of all, Schedule C's, political appointees, go around civil service rules, which exist so these jobs are fair, and so veterans' preferences, which are very important, all these rules are honored. But there's an exception for presidential appointees, as long as they're temporary, to advance the president's policies. Burrowing in goes against the law and civil service regulations. There are rules on when you're allowed to convert these positions under certain circumstances, but not after a certain date. I've heard many, many reports. There's been massive burrowing in at the State Department, and I'm very concerned that's going to be a big challenge for the next secretary.
Yeah. You know, a case in point, though not within the federal bureaucracy, but that sort of exemplifies this phenomenon is the transfer from the role of senior State Department official, I believe, Undersecretary of State, by Rose Gottmuller to be now recast as the Deputy Secretary General of NATO. And I have followed Rose's career for a long time, been horrified by her policy misjudgments, and fear greatly what she will do in that position. But it's the same kind of thing where the new president should have had the opportunity to put in place, I believe, somebody who reflects American policy at that high level as an American representative to NATO, rather than Will Scott Miller, whose views on many issues are, if anything, not terribly American, I think. Fred, we're going to pause for just a second. I'm going to ask you to stick around for a second segment, if I can, because there's been a very troubling development with respect to Putin's reset, as we call it in our new book. And I'm going to talk with you about it and its implications, the Iran deal, and much more. All that with Fred Flights right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We are continuing our conversation with my friend and colleague at the Center for Security Policy, Fred Flights, our Senior Vice President for Policy and Programs. Fred is, among other things, the editor of a very important new book entitled Putin's Reset, The Bear is Back and How America Must Respond. Fred, in the Washington Free Beacon today, our friend and regular contributor here at Secure Freedom Radio, Bill Gertz, has reported on the latest developments concerning a, well, monstrous new weapon that apparently Vladimir Putin is beginning to bring into his arsenal, an underwater nuclear-powered submarine drone that is apparently capable of deploying a 100-megaton cobalt nuclear or thermonuclear weapon. All of that sounds bad. Tell us how bad it is and what the implications might be should this come to pass.
Well, Frank, this represents a serious, serious policy failure by the Obama administration and, frankly, by Republicans in the Senate. You see, early in this administration, the New START treaty was passed. It is a treaty to address the American and Russian nuclear weapons, but it has some major flaws. It only addressed strategic weapons. It didn't address tactical weapons or new and novel weapons under development that we knew were under development. And I think we have to assume that this ultra-fast, underwater, nuclear-capable drone, which is basically an underwater nuclear missile, is something that was excluded from this treaty. I think the people who negotiated it knew that.
Including Rose Gottmuller, by the way.
I mean, they deliberately left out everything other than strategic weapons. And I mean, tactical weapons are a big problem. The Russians have a lot of them. We have a small number. These could be suitcase-sized nuclear weapons. They're not mentioned in the treaty. Nor are new ways of developing nuclear weapons. And this story, which Bill Gertz discusses, is an example of the kind of things that was deliberately left out.
To the extent that this weapons platform might be used, Fred Flights, based on what we know about it so far, and I think the original source was a purported inadvertent leak of classified information, but the Russians, there's some thought that perhaps this was a deliberate effort to either disinform or otherwise serve notice on us about their unhappiness concerning American policies, missile defenses, and the like. What would the scenario be for the use of a 100-megaton weapon with a very dirty bomb characteristic?
I mean, this is a capability to escape missile defenses. It is a very dangerous first strike weapon that could get very close to our territory before we could respond. And the size of the alleged size of the warhead is really frightening. It would do an enormous amount of damage. The Russians recently announced they're developing another nuclear weapon that could destroy an area the size of Texas. It's the largest nuclear weapon they've ever developed. I don't have the technical capability to tell you how a weapon of this size would detonate underwater, but I imagine if it detonated near New York City or another major city, the effect
would be enormous. Or Kings Bay submarine base, for example.
That's right. But I think the extent of the explosion would go over, would cover a vast area, even if detonated underwater.
Yeah. And what I'm told about these cobalt weapons is that they're particularly horrific because they're designed to irradiate and kill by irradiation, which would be very persistent, thereby making large areas of our country conceivably uninhabitable wastelands for many, many centuries. Fred Flights, put this into the context of this book on Putin's reset. What does it tell us? We talked earlier in the program with Rowan Scarborough about Jim Mattis's rather more hardline view of Putin. But when you put this together with his conduct in Ukraine and Syria, the buildup of his forces, particularly the nuclear ones, what's your overall assessment of the man? And do you think there's likely to have to be some changes in the rather more Pollyannish view of him that Donald Trump enunciated during the campaign?
Well, I think it's clear that neither presidential candidate seriously addressed the growing threat from Putin's Russia. And this concerns military threats, economic threats, cyber threats, economic threats, intelligence threats, and they're vast. And we described in Putin's reset, and you and I contributed to this, plus eight other experts, about how the Russians are really going to town and developing the military, developing base agreements worldwide so they can re-extend the reach of their Navy, developing advanced nuclear weapons, their effort to establish what I think will be a new Russian-led axis from Iraq to Iran at our expense. The situation, I think, from Syria to Iran at our expense. It's a very serious problem that's going to have to be revisited and studied very carefully by the next administration.
Hey, Fred, speaking of Iran, let me ask you very quickly. As I said earlier, you are the author of Obama Bomb, A Dangerous and Growing National Security Fraud, now in its second edition because of the continuing evidence of the size of this fraud. As you look at it now, the original statements by Donald Trump about walking away from the deal seem to be undergoing some modulation. What do you think he will do?
Well, I think there are people on the right and left trying to convince Mr. Trump that he can't back away from the agreement or renegotiate it, even though he said he would. I think that Mr. Trump will renegotiate the agreement, and he may tear it up because it is such an awful agreement that isn't stopping Iran's pursuit of nuclear weapons and has led to Iranian behavior in the region to get even worse. And we know this recently included intensified belligerence against American shipping in the Persian Gulf. So I just hope that Mr. Trump sticks to his guns and doesn't stick with these people who are trying to argue that we can't back away with the agreement because it will offend the Europeans.
One of the things that we're being told, Fred Flights, is that the Iranians may rip the deal up before he gets a chance to do it. I don't know whether to credit that or not, but one of the pretexts that they're citing is the recent virtually unanimous approval by the Congress of legislation extending some existing sanctions that are still in force. Talk a little bit about what's happened in the Congress recently, Fred, and what it might portend vis-a-vis the Iranians' future conduct.
Well, by a vote of 99-0 in the Senate and an almost unanimous vote in the House, the Iran Sanctions Act, which places sanctions on Iran for everything but nuclear proliferation and also sanctions Iran for terrorist activity, this act was renewed over the Obama administration's objections. The fact that there was such strong support for this, I think, really sends a message that even Democrats are upset at Iran's behavior after the nuclear deal. I don't think Iran's going to back out because of this agreement. I think this is simply empty rhetoric. This deal is simply too good for Iran. I think there will simply be a lot of threats by the Iranians that they're going to do this, but I don't think this will make them do it.
And to the extent that a Trump administration sought to renegotiate the deal, Fred Flights, knowing them as you do, what would be the incentive for the Iranians to go back into the negotiating table if they feel that the Europeans and elites that you've talked about will stand with them in preserving the existing arrangements?
Well, I think it will take considerable pressure over a number of years to get a legitimately tough agreement on Iran. I think we have to recognize we may never get a good nuclear agreement with Iran. But as President Obama once said, no deal is better than a bad deal. At a minimum, we have to impose sanctions on Iran to stop transfers of nuclear and missile technology and also any international banking assistance to those programs. That's not going to stop the Iranian nuclear program, but it is something we have to do to stop this program from morphing into an industrial-scale program that will be able to produce many, many nuclear weapons quite quickly.
Fred Flights, we have to leave it at that for the moment. I hope you all will check out these important works, Putin's Reset and Obama Bomb, for free at securefreedom.org. Keep it up, my friend. Come back to us very soon. I hope the rest of you will stay tuned for our next guest, Claudia Rosette, right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. To securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. A chance to visit with another world-class investigative reporter, Claudia Rosette. You find her writings these days at Forbes.com, PJ Media. She is a contributing editor to the New York Sun. She is a foreign policy fellow with the Independent Women's Forum, but she has also been very active for years with outfits like the Wall Street Journal, its editorial page, its overseas bureaus. She's a remarkable resource and always a welcome guest here. Claudia, thank you so much for coming back. It's good to talk with you.
Thank you, Frank. It's great to be here.
We're doing kind of an appreciation of the various individuals President-elect Donald Trump has selected to serve in cabinet and other important positions in his incoming administration. And Claudia, no one covers the UN beat better than you. So let me ask you what you make of his selection of South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley to be the U.S. ambassador there. What she's likely to be facing and how you think she might measure up.
Thanks, Frank. Well, my first thought is let's give her a chance. She came under fire right away for not having a lot of foreign policy experience. And I don't think that's the main credential, actually. You know, it's useful, but what you really need is a backbone and a lot of common sense. And what speaks well for her, for instance, is that she's one of the governors to oppose President Obama's terrible Iran nuclear deal. I would have actually preferred, say, a return of Ambassador John Bolton, although he's now in the running for Secretary of State.
Yeah, he may have something else, we're hoping.
Yeah, that would be actually a very good sign were that to happen. I would have preferred even a Rudy Giuliani, because I think that the main thing that an American ambassador needs is real backbone, because the UN is a place where they're just going to try and take you down, bury you, if you stand up for United States interests. The majority of the countries there are not actually free polities. The UN has served for so many years as a sort of gathering place, magnet for anti-Americanism. And that's the kind of thing that an ambassador there will be facing. And you can sort of run with the pack, which has been the norm, and really this works to America's detriment, or you can stand up to it, which has happened fairly rarely, very occasionally. Jean Kirkpatrick,
Patrick Moynihan.
There.
Yeah, comes to mind,
yeah,
as
exactly.
Well as John Bolton. And that's clearly what's needed. I think, as you know so well, Claudia, in part, of course, this will be a function of the character and the instincts and qualities of the ambassador. But to some extent as well, of course, the tone and the direction is set by the president and the Secretary of State. Well, hoping that all of these things will align to get us a Jean Kirkpatrick or John Bolton quality performance there by Nikki Haley. Let me ask you about another aspect of the UN at the moment. And again, nobody covers this beat better than you, Claudia, but it seems as though this is a little opaque, even by UN standards, which is saying something. What is it exactly that you anticipate Barack Obama will do with the French or with the connivance of others that might have a very deleterious effect on our friends in Israel? as this president heads for the door?
Well, that would be the lingering possibility that President Obama will try to come up with a solution to the Palestinian conflict. I'm going to say the Palestinian conflict against Israel, because the Israelis have tried over and over again to solve this thing, including pulling out of Gaza and turning it over to what became Hamas, right? That didn't work out at all. They ended up with rockets, further brief wars.
And tunnels and all kinds of jihadism.
Exactly. And President Obama, the problem is sort of like his move to normalize relations with Cuba. Suddenly, it appears. And in fact, it appeared suddenly in December of 2 years ago, right, with Cuba. And he doesn't really give notice. He doesn't go through the process you would hope that a president would in trying to build real support in the United States for anything like that.
In fact, I think he's gotten a lot of pushback on that idea from the Hill at the moment on a bipartisan basis. But do you expect, nonetheless, he will try to foist something in the way of new boundaries, or maybe even helping the Palestinians be admitted to the UN as a full member? I mean, it's unbelievable, but might he yet try to do something as outrageous as that, Claudia Rosette?
Frank, I don't have material information on this, so I can't pretend that I know.
No, just speculate away.
I can certainly warn you.
Yes, warning.
He has a record of doing this sort of thing. Remember the secret talks with Iran that preceded the rotten nuclear deal. As I just mentioned, the sudden announcement, he's now on the phone to Raul Castro in Cuba. These things that he just does because he uses the bully pulpit that way. It's one of the reasons he's now so worried that his so-called legacies are going to slide into sand, because they've been built on sand with no real attempt to build support here. On Israel, he has treated Israel horrifically during his presidency. He has snubbed its prime minister. He has strengthened Iran in the region. He has undercut the United States to Israel's detriment and to ours on things like terrorism, especially in the Middle East. It's been an appalling record. So would it be consistent with that record that during this final moment, when you would think a president would have enough respect for the republic, for the voters, for the country, the will of Americans, not to do something of major proportions on the foreign policy front, like try to suddenly do something that would basically really endanger Israel, delegitimize it at the UN, or put it in that spot of being easy to delegitimize as the UN measures these things, try to define borders that could not possibly be defended, set it up with a deal with the Palestinians that the Israelis simply could not sign on to and expect to survive. So they would be in the terrible spot of having to choose between trying to please that at the UN, it truly is an anti-Semitic international community, or putting themselves in real existential danger, or defying everyone even more. Is it likely that he might do this? Well, it's likelier than with anybody else I can think of who's been in the presidency in our lifetime. So it's a very real danger, Frank, and it's a pity that that's so.
Let me ask you finally, speaking of a prime example of this, the Iran deal. Claudia, you've written at PJ Media about the Trump folks coming in. They've got the landing team. They've got the beachhead group and so on. What they may be getting their hands on, or what they should be getting their hands on in terms of the secret documents that the Obama administration has kept from Congress and kept from the public.
Well, there's a whole archive there, presumably, of secrets that are really quite disturbing, including things such as what really went on with that payment of $1.7 billion in cash to Iran that President Obama apparently approved and had shipped over there early this year. $1.7 billion with a B in three installments, which the administration in cash, okay, cash, air freighted in. There's no legitimate use I can think of that would have the Iranians asking for that to be sent in cash. When you do that, and you're a country like Iran, the world's leading terror-sponsoring state, the likely use for such money, how does it lend itself, is that it is reparceled out of sight in Iran, really hard to trace, and given to whatever dirty purposes they need cash for.
Claudia Rosette, thank you so much for all of these really important insights and thoughtful observations. We appreciate so much what you do at the Independent Women's Forum and, of course, Forbes and PJ Media, the New York Sun, and with us from time to time. Do come back to us again very soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.